I mean officers in the militia and deacons in the church. The line I have just described makes about 160 years, in which no bankruptcy was ever committed, no widow or orphan was ever defrauded, no redemptor intervened, and no debt was contracted with England. The old stubborn independence of his forebears kept playing on his thoughts. It had been the bedrock of their integrity, and he was resolved to see it sustained. When his son Thomas wrote, expressing an interest in public life, Adams felt he was answering for generations of their line. "Public business, my son, must always be done by somebody. It will be done by somebody or other. If wise men decline it, others will not. If honest men refuse it, others will not." A young man should weigh well his plans. Integrity should be preserved in all events as essential to his happiness through every stage of his existence. His first maxim, then, should be to place his honor out of reach of all men. In order to do this, he must make it a rule never to become dependent on public employments for subsistence. Let him have a trade, a profession, a farm, a shop, something where he can honestly live, and then he may engage in public affairs, if invited, upon independent principles. My advice to my children is to maintain an independent character. Other than a few stiff social occasions, Adams had little contact with the president and no influence. But as yet, it seemed no one had any influence with Washington. He seeks information from all quarters and judges more independently than any man I ever saw, Adams wrote approvingly. In the choice of the cabinet, Adams is not known to have been asked an opinion or to have offered any. It was to be a geographically balanced cabinet, with New England, the Middle States, and the South represented, and all four positions were promptly confirmed by the Senate. Hamilton of New York as Secretary of the Treasury, Jefferson, Secretary of State, Edmund Randolph of Virginia, Attorney General, and Henry Knox of Massachusetts as Secretary of War. If not the most intellectually outstanding of the four, Knox was certainly the most physically noticeable, having acquired over the years an immense girth, to the point of weighing nearly 300 pounds. For Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Washington chose John Jay. It was thus to be a government led by revolutionaries, all men who had taken part in the Revolution. Washington, by common agreement, was the greatest man in the world. And in Adams, Hamilton, Jefferson, Madison, and Jay, the American people could fairly claim to have the best minds in the country. And however striking their differences in temperament or political philosophy, they were, without exception, men dedicated primarily to seeing the American experiment succeed. Adams approved of all the choices for the cabinet. Such was his regard for Hamilton at this point, he arranged for young Charles to clerk in Hamilton's Wall Street law office until Hamilton commenced his duties as Secretary of the Treasury when Charles moved on to another firm. So through late summer, father and son could be seen riding off to work together each morning in the one-horse chaise. Section 3. In September, as Congress took up the question of where to locate the permanent capital, and the President prepared for a tour of New England, news came of revolution in France. It was a bolt out of the blue, catching everyone by surprise. And the event that was to make the already difficult business of founding the new American government still more complicated and contentious. In the life of John Adams, the old issue of America's relations with France was to bear heavily and fatefully yet again. On July 14th, an enraged mob had stormed and captured the Bastille. the ancient Paris prison that had come to symbolize an intolerable regime. All its prisoners, numbering just 7 and none of them political, had been set free. Its commander had been beaten to death and decapitated, his dripping head then carried through the streets on a pike. In the days that followed, as rampaging mobs took over the city, one elderly Paris official was hanged from a lamppost, another cut to pieces, his heart torn from his body and brandished from a window of the Hôtel de Ville. The headline of the New York Daily Gazette, September 19, 1789, announced a complete revolution in France. The National Assembly was proceeding to form a new constitution. France, friend and ally in America's struggle for freedom, was now herself taking up the cause. And nearly everywhere in America, the news was greeted with enthusiasm. "France seems travailing in the birth of freedom," wrote William Maclay. "Her throes and pangs of labor are violent. God give her a happy delivery. Royalty, nobility, and vile pageantry, by which a few of the human race lord it over and tread on the necks of their fellow mortals, seem like to be demolished with their kindred Bastille, which is said to be laid in ashes. Ye gods! With what indignation do I review the late attempt of some creatures among us to revive the vile machinery. Oh, Adams, Adams, what a wretch thou art!" For Adams, the news from France had the effect of an alarm bell. Heedless of the troubles he had already brought on himself with his defense of the constitutions, he took up his pen and launched into a series of newspaper essays, determined to show again the evil effects of unbalanced governments. He consulted no one, asked for no advice or opinion from others. Working under intense, self-imposed pressure, he wrote straight out, on and on, never pausing to rewrite or edit himself, which would have helped and for which he later apologized. He labored at these essays for months, during which Congress adjourned and he returned to Massachusetts to join Washington for part of his visit there, proudly escorting the president on a tour of Harvard. But even before the first of the essays appeared, he let it be known that while he understood the reasons for the revolution in France, the oppressive abuses of the government, the overbearing and costly armies of monks, soldiers, and courtiers, and though he strongly supported the ideals espoused by French patriots, he viewed the situation with dire misgivings. "The French Revolution," he wrote to a Dutch friend, Francis van der Kemp, "will, I hope, produce effects in favor of liberty, equity, and humanity as extensive as this whole globe and as lasting as all time." Yet he could not help foresee a tragic outcome, in that a single legislative assembly, as chosen by the French, could only mean great and lasting calamities. To the Reverend Richard Price in London, who had preached a widely publicized sermon in support of what was happening in France, Adams acknowledged feeling a sense of satisfaction and triumph in the revolution. Nor did he doubt its immense historic importance. "It appears to me that most of the events in the annals of the world are but childish tales compared to it," Adams declared. Later, having read Price's sermon, he said such principles and sentiments as Price expressed had been, "from the year 1760 to this hour, the whole scope of my life." But he had learned by awful experience to rejoice with trembling. He could not accept the idea of enshrining reason as a religion, as desired by the philosophe. "I know not what to make of a republic of 30 million atheists." From experience, he knew the kinds of men such upheavals could give rise to, Adams told another correspondent. In revolutions, he warned, the most fiery spirits and flighty geniuses frequently obtained more influence than men of sense and judgment, and the weakest man may carry foolish measures in opposition to wise ones proposed by the ablest. France was in great danger. Ahead of anyone in the government, and more clearly than any, Adams foresaw the French Revolution leading to chaos, horror, and ultimate tyranny. In London, meanwhile, the fiery Irish-born statesman Edmund Burke, who had once been the American Revolution's strongest friend in Parliament, declared in a speech that the French were proving themselves the ablest architects of ruin who ever existed. "In one summer they have done their business. They have completely pulled down to the ground their monarchy, their church, their nobility, their law, their revenue, their army, their navy, their commerce, their arts, and their manufacturers." The French, said Burke, sounding very like Adams, had destroyed all balances and counterpoises which served to fix a state and give it steady direction. And then they melted down the whole into one incongruous mass of mob and democracy. Burke adamantly opposed such English enthusiasm for the revolution in France as espoused by Richard Price, which he thought woefully irresponsible. And the speech, which was published in full in New York in the Gazette of the United States, was but a prelude to what would be Burke's most famous book, Reflections on the French Revolution, published late in 1790. Adams, too, took up the architectural theme in a letter to his old fellow revolutionary Samuel Adams. "Everything will be pulled down, so much seems certain," he wrote. "But what will be built up? Are there any principles of political architecture? Will the struggle in Europe be anything other than a change in impostors?" That September, Jefferson, with his daughters Patsy and Polly, and slaves James and Sally Hemings, landed at Norfolk, Virginia, where he learned for the first time that he had been named Secretary of State. He had left Paris well after the fall of the Bastille, and though he had witnessed none of the bloodshed of the summer, he had known what was happening and approved, convinced the violence would soon end and that for France a glorious new day had dawned. When Jefferson arrived at Monticello, according to traditional family accounts, his slaves were so overjoyed to see him, they unhitched his horses and pulled his carriage up the last ridge of the mountain, then carried Master in their arms into his house. It seemed impossible to satisfy their anxiety to touch and kiss the very earth which bore him, Patsy Jefferson would write. Jefferson remained at Monticello through the winter, for nearly 3 months, during which Patsy, at 17, was married to a cousin, Thomas Randolph, Jr., after little or no courtship. As a wedding present, Jefferson gave the young couple 1,000 acres and 12 families of slaves, and helped in the eventual purchase of a nearby plantation for them called Edgehill, all of which necessitated an additional loan of several thousand dollars, this time from bankers in Amsterdam. In early March, Jefferson started for New York, stopping briefly at Philadelphia to pay a last visit to Benjamin Franklin, who was mortally ill. Calling on Benjamin Rush shortly afterward, Jefferson assured his old friend he was as faithful a Republican as ever, and deplored the change in John Adams. He regarded Adams with respect and affection as a great and upright man, Jefferson said, but the greatest man in the world, he had lately concluded, was Madison. At New York, Jefferson took a lease on a house on Maiden Lane, and immediately, inevitably, ordered that extensive alterations be made inside and out, despite the fact that New York was not expected to remain the capital much longer. James Hemings, now accomplished in the art of French cookery, was installed in the kitchen, and a letter went off to Paris telling Adrien Petit to come as soon as possible. With the death of Franklin on April 17th, Philadelphia staged the greatest public homage that had ever been given a deceased American. In New York, The House of Representatives voted to put on mourning, but the Senate declined. When Jefferson proposed to Washington that the executive department follow the example of the House, Washington too declined, saying he would not know where to draw the line if he once began such a ceremony. Adams's only known response to the news of Franklin's demise was in a letter to Rush in which he lamented the lies history would tell of our revolution. "The essence of the whole will be that Dr. Franklin's electrical rod smote the earth and outsprung General Washington, that Franklin electrified him with his rod, and thenceforward these two conducted all the policy, negotiation, legislation, and war." The reunion of the Adamses and Jefferson in New York was appropriately amicable. They saw each other socially at dinners and presidential levees, and on more than one occasion Jefferson rode out to Richmond Hill. "Jefferson is here and adds much to the social circle," Abigail noted, but that was all. Jefferson, in his letters home to Patsy, whom he addressed as Martha now that she was a married woman, made no mention of the Adamses. The Gazette of the United States had by now carried the text of a formal reply by Jefferson to the welcome he had received from his Virginia neighbors. It was a declaration of his faith in reason and democracy that he had taken great pains over. "It rests now with ourselves to enjoy in peace and concord the blessings of self-government so long denied to mankind, to show by example the sufficiency of human reason for the care of human affairs, and that the will of the majority, the natural law of every society, is the only sure guardian of the rights of man. Perhaps even this may sometimes err, but its errors are honest, solitary, and short-lived. Let us then, my dear friends, forever bow down to the general reason of society." But to Adams, the sufficiency of reason alone for the care of human affairs was by no means clear. And it was exactly the will of the majority, particularly as being exercised in France, that so gravely concerned him. He was certain France had severe trials to endure, as he wrote to a friend. The will of the majority, if out of hand, could lead to horrible ravages, he was sure. "My fundamental maxim of government is never to trust the lamb to the wolf." And in France, he feared, the wolf was now the majority. Adams's series of articles also commenced in the Gazette of the United States that spring of 1790 on April 27th, and would continue for a year, endlessly it seemed to many. Though they were unsigned, the identity of the author was common knowledge. Titled Discourses on Davila, and ultimately published as a book, they were largely a translation of a history of the French civil wars of the 16th century, a once popular work, Historia delle guerre civili di Francia, by the Italian Enrico Caterino Davila, first published in 1630. More than he had in his defense of the constitutions, Adams stressed the perils of unbridled, unbalanced democracy. And in what he called useful reflections, he dealt with human nature, drawing heavily on the works of Adam Smith, Samuel Johnson, Shakespeare, and Voltaire, and on Pope's Essay on Man. In the initial installments, he wrote again, as he had as far back as his teaching days at Worcester, of the natural passion for distinction in all men and women. Whether they be old or young, rich or poor, high or low, wise or foolish, ignorant or learned, every individual is seen to be strongly actuated by a desire to be seen, heard, talked of, approved, and respected. To be wholly overlooked and to know it are intolerable, wrote the man who, as vice president, felt himself so consistently overlooked. He ruminated on avarice, poverty, fame, and honor. No one, he wrote, better understood the human heart than the Romans, who considered that as reason is the guide of life, the senses, the imagination, and affections are the springs of activity. Unlike Jefferson, Adams was not only fascinated by the passions, but certain they ruled more often than others were willing to concede. Reason holds the helm, but passions are the gales. The world was growing more enlightened, Adams conceded. Knowledge is more diffused. Man as man becomes an object of respect. But, he insisted, there was great reason to pause and preserve our sobriety. Amidst all their exultations, Americans and Frenchmen should remember that the perfectibility of man is only human and terrestrial perfectibility. Cold will still freeze, and fire will never cease to burn. Disease and vice will continue to disorder, and death to terrify mankind. Between Jefferson and Adams, there was no discussion of their diverging views. To Jefferson, Adams had become an embarrassment. And while always pleasant in social encounters, Jefferson had as little as possible to do with him. On matters of foreign relations, where Adams's judgment could have been of value, Jefferson would never seek his counsel or include him in deliberations. Washington seldom asked Adams for views, but Jefferson, who in Europe had deferred repeatedly to Adams, asked for them not at all. Like Washington and many others, Adams had become increasingly distraught over the rise of political divisiveness, the forming of parties or factions. That political parties were an evil that could bring the ruination of Republican government was doctrine he, with others, had long accepted and espoused. There is nothing I dread so much as a division of the Republic into two great parties, each arranged under its leader and converting measures in opposition to each other, Adams had observed to a correspondent while at Amsterdam, before the revolution ended. Yet this was exactly what had happened. The turbulent maneuvers of factions, he now wrote privately, could tie the hands and destroy the influence of every honest man with a desire to serve the public good. There was division of sentiments over everything, he told his son-in-law, William Smith. How few aim at the good of the whole without aiming too much at the prosperity of parts. Then, in May, with the weather unseasonably wet and cold and influenza rampant in the city, Washington was suddenly taken so ill it appeared the one unifying force respected by all was in mortal jeopardy. In the first 6 months of his presidency, Washington had lived in a comparatively modest house on Cherry Street, but had since moved to grander quarters, a mansion on Broadway, where now the street was cordoned off to give him some quiet. One doctor after another came and went at the front door. For several days, until the fever broke, it appeared the president was dying. Senator McClay, on a call at the house, found every eye full of tears. When the president's presiding physician allowed that death was all but certain, alarm swept through the city. Calamity faced the country. For the Adamses, they were days of extreme anxiety. When the crisis passed, Abigail tried to convey to Mary Cranch the degree to which the union and permanency of the government depended on Washington's life. At this early day, when neither our finances are arranged nor our government sufficiently cemented to promise duration, his death would, I fear, have had most disastrous consequences. The prospect of anyone succeeding to Washington's place was unthinkable. But the realization that there was indeed only one breath, as John had put it, between him and the presidency, and that it would be he who would have to face the disastrous consequences, had struck her full force as it had not before. "I feared a thousand things which I pray I never may be called to experience," she continued. Most assuredly, I do not wish for the highest spot. I never before realized what I might be called to do, and the apprehension of it only for a few days greatly distressed me. Meantime, the entire household at Richmond Hill was stricken with influenza, with the exception of the vice president. James Madison had been laid up. One congressman died. Jefferson was out of circulation for a month, confined to his house in the grip of excruciating headaches. That one had to keep a good heart, come what may, was Abigail's lifelong creed. "A merry heart doeth good like a medicine," she loved to say, quoting Proverbs. "I hate to complain," she now wrote. "No one is without difficulties, whether in high or low life, and every person knows best where their own shoe pinches." That June of 1790, with the president recovered, the French diplomat, Louis-Guillaume Otto, summing up the situation in New York for his government, reported that the influence and importance of the vice president were nil. If Washington had an heir apparent, by all rights it was Jefferson. "It appears certain at present that he, Adams, will never be president, and that he will have a very formidable competitor in Mr. Jefferson, who, with more talents and knowledge than he, has infinitely more the principles and manners of a Republican." That summer, Congress worked itself to a fever pitch over two issues certain to be of long-lasting consequence. The question of where to locate the national capital had been a topic of rancorous discussion since the summer before, and was again at the forefront, along with a proposal for the federal government to assume some $25 million in debts incurred by the states during the Revolution. The Assumption Plan was the work of the youthful Hamilton, who, since his appointment, had swiftly made the Treasury the most creative department in the government, and was commonly recognized as having extraordinary ability. An immigrant of illegitimate birth, Hamilton had arrived in New York from the West Indies at age 15. In less than 10 years, he had distinguished himself as a scholar at King's, later Columbia College, served as Washington's aide in the war, led an assault at Yorktown, and married into the wealthy, influential Schuyler family of New York, which did him no harm when after the war he turned his energies to the law and politics. Brilliant to the point of genius, he exuded vitality and could turn on great charm when needed. His capacity for hard work was almost superhuman. Though somewhat shorter than Adams, about 5'7", he was attractively slender, handsome, with clear blue eyes and sandy red hair, and dressed so as never to be lost in a crowd, in perfectly tailored coats, waistcoats, and breeches in a rainbow of colors. Even his ambition seemed to become him. Adams wrote of Hamilton's high-minded ambition, and his incurable love of intrigue had thus far alienated no one. As one of the principal authors, along with Madison, of the Federalist Papers, Hamilton ranked as a leading proponent of a strong central government, and his name was commonly linked with that of Madison, with whom he remained on friendly terms. Further, both were highly esteemed by the president, which was of considerable importance. Madison, a tiny, sickly-looking man who weighed little more than 100 pounds and dressed always in black, had emerged as the most formidable figure in the House, largely on the strength of a penetrating intelligence and a shrewd political sense. Adams thought him overrated, but in time, Adams would change his mind. Hamilton's Assumption Plan had first been laid before Congress the previous January 1790, as part of a large report in which he argued that a sound public credit was essential to economic growth and national unity. He had called for the central government to pay off all federal debt and to assume the debts of the states as well, on the grounds that they had been incurred in the common cause of independence. Boldly, Hamilton argued that such an increase in the national debt would be a blessing, for the greater the responsibility of the central government, the greater its authority. He was vehemently opposed, however, by those who saw it as an overreaching and very unrepublican move to concentrate power in the central government to the detriment of the states. To Southerners in the Congress, the scheme would not only reduce the importance of the states, but would lead to a dangerous, ultimately corrupting concentration of wealth and power in the North. And it was Madison now, breaking with Hamilton, who led the opposition in the House, where Assumption was put to the vote on April 12th and narrowly defeated. Still, the battle continued, and at the same time that the location of the capital, the residence issue, had become a subject of equal rancor. New Yorkers, eager to keep the capital where it was, had begun building an executive mansion for Washington by the Battery, with a grand panorama of the harbor. New Englanders also favored New York, it being much the easiest location for them to reach, though Philadelphia, adamantly espoused by the Pennsylvanians, was considered an acceptable alternative. The Virginians wanted no part of either of the northern cities, and were strongly committed to bringing the capital south to a site on the Potomac River not far from Washington's home at Mount Vernon. Those most adjacent to the seat of legislation will always possess advantages over others, said Madison, who feared that the South and its agrarian way of life would suffer were the capital to remain in the North. In the Senate, charges and countercharges were voiced with increasing vehemence. Adams struggled to keep order, and apparently with little effect. John Adams has neither judgment, firmness of mind, nor respectability of deportment to fill the chair of such an assembly, scoffed the ever-splenetic William McClay. Then, on a morning in June, the historic Compromise of 1790 began to take form. When Hamilton and Jefferson met outside the president's house, and Hamilton, taking Jefferson by the arm, walked him up and down for half an hour, urging him, for the sake of the Union, to join in common cause and resolve acceptance of the Assumption Bill. Professing that reasonable men ought to be able to reach a compromise, Jefferson invited Hamilton and Madison to dine at his house the next day. And there, over a bottle of Jefferson's best wine, the bargain was struck. In return for Southern support for the Assumption Bill, Hamilton agreed to do all he could to persuade the Pennsylvanians to vote for a permanent capital by the Potomac, if it were agreed to move the capital temporarily to Philadelphia. Madison said he would not vote for Assumption, but then neither would he be strenuous in opposition. Whether, in fact, the outcome was resolved in this fashion is not altogether clear. But certainly Jefferson believed the bargain had been settled. For on July 1st, he wrote William Short in Paris to have his furniture and paintings shipped to Philadelphia. The crucial vote on residence, however, was made not in the House but in the Senate, where apparently an agreement had already been reached between the Pennsylvanians and the Virginians. When a last-minute motion to keep the capital in New York for two more years resulted in a 13-13 tie, Adams cast a nay vote. By July 12th, both houses of Congress had voted to relocate the capital in Philadelphia for 10 years, until the turn of the century, after which it would move to a permanent site on the Potomac. The Pennsylvanians went along with the agreement, convinced that once the capital was located in Philadelphia, it would never move. Adams was inclined to agree. A capital, he said, ought to be in a great city, an idea no Virginian would ever have entertained. With the passage of the Assumption Bill at the end of the month came cries of intrigues, cabals, and combinations. New Yorkers were outraged. Senator McClay speculated that if the truth were known, Washington was behind the whole arrangement, which, indeed, he was. And in the first public criticism of the president, the New York Advertiser charged him with gross ingratitude to the city of New York. As soon as Congress adjourned on August 12th, the government began packing for the move. The president and Mrs. Washington departed for Mount Vernon, while the vice president set off for Philadelphia to find a house, leaving Abigail in despair over the thought of leaving Richmond Hill, and particularly as Nabby gave birth to a third child that summer, another boy named Thomas. By late fall, the Adamses were resettled in a substantial brick house 2 miles west of Philadelphia, overlooking the Schuylkill. Called Bush Hill, it was another setting of idyllic charm, except that the British Army during the occupation had left hardly a tree or bush standing. Washington arrived and moved into the Robert Morris House on Market Street, considered the grandest residence in Philadelphia. General Sir William Howe had made it his headquarters during the occupation. Jefferson, too, took a house on Market, just blocks away, where his additions this time included a library, stable, and garden house. He had furniture sent on from Monticello, and eventually his treasures from France arrived in no less than 80 packing cases, a quantity of purchases such as no one American had ever brought back from Europe. On Monday, December 6th, Congress reconvened in Congress Hall, formerly the Philadelphia County Courthouse, a two-story red brick building erected since the war on the west side of the State House. As at Federal Hall in New York, the House of Representatives met on the first floor, the Senate on the floor above. The Supreme Court would sit in what had been City Hall, a corresponding brick building on the east side of the State House. For all that Philadelphia had grown and changed, it was familiar territory for Adams, filled with memories. He was happy to be back, and once she had overcome another spell of poor health, Abigail was writing of her delight in seeing the dazzling Mrs. Bingham again, and of Mrs. Washington's Friday evenings, where fine ladies show themselves, and as candlelight is a great improver of beauty, they appear to great advantage. The president was as fond of theater as were the Adamses, and invited them to accompany him and Mrs. Washington to performances at the Southwark Theater. They dined several times at the presidential mansion, and the president and his lady, in a rare exception to his rule of accepting no invitations, came to dine at Bush Hill. So bone-chilling was the cold of that winter. Every fireplace at Bush Hill had to be kept blazing, and Abigail's principal problem with new servants this time was that they were so frequently drunk. But her house was full of life, as she wrote. Son Thomas, having finished at Harvard, came to live with his mother and father. Charles rode down from New York for periodic visits, bringing his customary good cheer. When John Quincy traveled from Boston for a stay in February, Abigail was able to report to Sister Mary that for the first time in years she had all three sons together under her roof. Like her husband, Abigail had the highest hopes for their eldest son. The time would come, she said, when this young man will be sought as a jewel of great price. But John Quincy did not look well, and seemed to have lost much of his sprightliness and vivacity. The year before, while still at Newburyport, he had fallen in love with a 15-year-old girl, Mary Fraser, and was strongly advised by his parents that both he and the girl were too young for a serious attachment. By autumn, the romance was broken off. Now, Abigail reported to Mary Cranch, the young man fretted that his Boston law practice was so slow taking hold. We all preach patience to him. But her greater worry was Nabby, whose husband, with a growing family and no profession, had suddenly gone off to England on some kind of speculative venture. Happily, America was prospering, commerce and agriculture both flourishing, and there was increasing confidence everywhere. Secretary Hamilton's proposed national bank, the centerpiece of his plan and now before Congress, had the support of nearly everyone, Abigail reported to Cotton Tufts. There was not a doubt that the bill would pass, and by a considerable majority, she assured the trusted family advisor. As she predicted, the bill for the Bank of the United States passed by a sizable majority, despite opposition from Madison and Jefferson, who urged the president to exercise a veto on constitutional grounds. But Hamilton's views carried greater weight with Washington, who signed the bill on February 25th. Better versed on financial matters than her husband, Abigail wanted to invest immediately in government securities. But as she told Cotton Tufts, Mr. Adams held to his faith in land as true wealth. Indeed, Adams not only put his trust in land as the safest of investments, but agreed in theory with Jefferson and Madison that an agricultural society was inherently more stable than any other, not to say more virtuous. Like most farmers, he had strong misgivings about banks, and candidly admitted his ignorance of coin and commerce. Yet he was as pleased by the rise of enterprise and prosperity as anyone, and in moments of discouragement over public life, even contemplated going into the China trade. As strong as his attachment to life lived close to the land may have been, Adams liked what he saw happening. "Never since I was born was America so happy as at this time." Had the Adamses invested in government securities as Abigail wished, they would almost certainly have wound up quite wealthy. Nowhere in the dozens of personal letters they had written in more than a year had either John or Abigail made mention of Jefferson. To judge by their correspondence, he might still have been in France. It was not that they never saw him. Rather, it seems that if they had nothing good to say, they said nothing. But then that spring of 1791, Adams and Jefferson were caught up in a public controversy that neither anticipated or wanted, and that put the first severe strain on their already cooling friendship. The effect on national politics would be profound, and as was perhaps inevitable, the root cause was the revolution in France. In furious response to Edmund Burke's book, Reflections on the Revolution in France, Thomas Paine, who was then in England, had produced a pamphlet, The Rights of Man, that attacked Burke and set forth an impassioned defense of human rights, liberties, and equality. Jefferson, on receiving an early copy, promptly passed it on to a Philadelphia printer with a note warmly endorsing it as the answer to the political heresies that have sprung up among us. When the printer published a first American edition, Jefferson's endorsement appeared prominently on the title page and was attributed to the Secretary of State. The endorsement caused a sensation. Jefferson claimed to be astonished, but privately confirmed that by political heresies, he meant the writings of John Adams. In a letter of explanation to Washington, he said he was mortified to be thus brought forward on the public stage against my love of silence and quiet and my abhorrence of dispute. He greatly regretted that the indiscretion of a printer had doubtless offended his friend Mr. Adams, for whom, as one of the most honest and disinterested men alive, I have cordial esteem, despite his apostasy to hereditary monarchy. But to Adams, Jefferson said nothing. Weeks passed, during which Adams, deeply offended, kept silent, then returned to Braintree for a brief visit. Presently, when a series of spirited letters signed Publicola began appearing in Boston's Columbian Sentinel, attacking the rights of man and its sponsor, Jefferson, like many readers, assumed Publicola was Adams. In fact, it was John Quincy, who, rising to the defense of his father, took Jefferson to task for claiming that a difference in political opinion might be declared heresy, and those who differed in view from the Secretary of State were therefore heretics. "I am somewhat at a loss to determine," he wrote, "what this very respectable gentleman means by political heresies. Does he consider this pamphlet of Mr. Paine's as a canonical book of political scripture? As containing the true doctrine of popular infallibility, from which it would be heretical to depart in one single point? I have always understood, sir, that the citizens of these states were possessed of a full and entire freedom of opinion upon all subjects, civil as well as religious. They have not yet established any infallible criterion of orthodoxy, either in church or state, and the only political tenet which they could stigmatize with the name of heresy would be that which should attempt to impose an opinion upon their understandings upon the single principle of authority." Jefferson let 3 months pass before sending Adams a rather stiff letter of apology and explanation, which, though well-intentioned, hardly sufficed. Written at Philadelphia, the letter was dated July 17, 1791. He had taken up his pen a dozen times, and, as often, put it down. "Suspended between opposing considerations," Jefferson began. "I determine, however, to write from a conviction that truth between candid minds can never do harm." He had written what he had about heresies, he said, only to take off a little of the dryness of the note. He had been thunderstruck by the printer's use of the note. He had hoped it would attract no attention, and implied it might not have but for the fuss over the Publicola series. It was because of Publicola that our names were thrown on the public stage as public antagonists. "That you and I differ in our idea of the best form of government is well known to us both, but we have differed as friends should do, respecting the purity of each other's motives, and confiding our differences of opinion to private conversation. And I can declare with truth in the presence of the Almighty that nothing was further from my intention or expectation than to have either my own or your name brought before the public on this occasion. The friendship and confidence which has so long existed between us required this explanation from me, and I know you too well to fear any misconstruction of the motives of it." Never in his life, Jefferson added, had he written anything for newspapers anonymously or under a pseudonym, and he never intended to. He did not tell Adams, as he had Washington, that he had Adams specifically in mind as the perpetrator of heresies. Nor did he say that he knew by then that Publicola was John Quincy. Jefferson's source was Madison, who had also observed that the young man's style was notably less clumsy than that of the father. Adams answered Jefferson at once, and with obvious feeling. He accepted Jefferson's account of what had happened, but allowed that the printer had sown the seeds of more evils than he could ever atone for. He, Adams, had been held up to ridicule in one newspaper after another for his meanness. The New Haven Gazette had called him an unprincipled libeler, his love of monarchy, his antipathy to freedom. Adams vehemently denied that he favored monarchy. "If you suppose that I have or ever had a design or desire of attempting to introduce a government of kings, lords, and commons, or in other words a hereditary executive or a hereditary senate, either into the government of the United States or that of any individual state in this country, you are wholly mistaken. If you have ever put such a construction on anything of mine, I beg you would mention it to me, and I will undertake to convince you that it has no such meaning." The problem was that so many who criticized his writings had never bothered to read them, Adams said. Some misunderstood them, others willfully misrepresented them. Either way, he had been made the victim of tempestuous abuse. That Jefferson himself had once praised his defense of the Constitution's, apparently finding no heresies therein, Adams, to his credit, made no mention. He took issue only with Jefferson's claim that their differences on the best form of government were well known to both of them. This was simply not so, Adams wrote. You and I have never had a serious conversation together that I can recollect concerning the nature of government. He was not publicola, and he had had no hand in writing the essays, Adams assured Jefferson, but refrained from identifying the author. What troubled him most, he said, was the mounting enmity between public men. I must own to you that the daring traits of ambition and intrigue, and those unbridled rivalries which have already appeared, are the most melancholy and alarming systems that I have ever seen in this country. If this was what politics came to, then the sooner he was out of it, the happier he would be. At the last, Adams left no doubt of how much Jefferson and his friendship meant to him. I thank you, sir, very seriously for writing to me. It is high time that you and I should come to an explanation with each other. The friendship that has subsisted for 15 years between us without the smallest interruption, and until this occasion without the slightest suspicion, ever has been and still is very dear to my heart. There is no office which I would not resign rather than give a just occasion to one friend to forsake me. Your motives for writing to me, I have not a doubt, were the most pure and the most friendly. And I have no suspicion that you will not receive this explanation from me in the same candid light. Jefferson would have been better off had he let the matter drop. Instead, he wrote again, speciously insisting that blame for the controversy rested with publicola. Then, in what must have been an effort to spare Adams's feelings, he went further. In direct contradiction to what he told Washington, Jefferson denied to Adams that he had ever had him in mind when he wrote to the printer. Indeed, it was impossible that my note should occasion your name to be brought into question, for, as far from naming you, I had not even in view any writing which I might suppose to be yours. Thus I hope, my dear sir, that you will see me to have been innocent in effect, as I was in intention. In sum, Jefferson refused to take any responsibility for what had happened. To Washington, he cited the indiscretion of a printer. To Adams, he said John Quincy was the cause of the trouble, and that he himself was innocent of ever even thinking of Adams in the first place. But it was not Jefferson who had suffered abuse and ridicule in the press. It was Adams, and the damage done was extreme, given the overwhelming popularity of both Thomas Paine and the French Revolution. From this point on, Adams and Jefferson were seldom to be perceived as anything other than arch rivals. The public stage that Jefferson said he wished to avoid, the growing enmity between public men that Adams abhorred, had made them in the public mind symbols of the emerging divisions in national politics. Further, in what he had written to Madison, and in what he had said in his note to the printer, Jefferson had tagged Adams with being both mentally unsound and a monarchist, the two charges most commonly and unjustly made against him for the rest of his life. Adams let the matter drop. He made no reply to Jefferson's last letter, and there would be no further correspondence between them for several years. The explanation with each other that Adams hoped for would have to wait for more than 2 decades. In the autumn of 1791, alarmed to find they were living beyond their means, Abigail and John moved from Bush Hill to a modest dwelling in town at 4th and Arch Streets. Servants were let go, except for Breesler and a cook, a clever, sober, honest, free black woman, as Abigail reported to Mary Cranch. "We live sociably and friendly together," she wrote, and in many ways felt they were all better off living in town. But with winter came the inevitable siege of illnesses, and for Abigail, beset mainly by rheumatism, attended with a violent fever, it was as miserable a time as she had known. Her eyes became so inflamed she could not bear any light in her room, not even the fire to blaze. After 6 weeks in bed, she was still too feeble to go downstairs without being carried. "I have scarcely any flesh left in comparison to what I was." Dr. Rush came in several times to draw blood, and in the mistaken belief that the human body contained more blood than it actually does, it was his practice to bleed patients far more than customary. At times he was known to remove as much as 80 ounces, which could well explain Abigail's feeble state. The news that Colonel Smith, newly returned from London, was to sail again on the next packet, and would be taking Nabby and the children with him, left her feelings still more dreadful. "The everlasting fever hung on," she wrote weeks later, confiding also that the critical period of midlife compounded her troubles. She brooded over the brevity of life. "How soon may our fairest prospects be leveled with the dust and show us that man in his best estate is but vanity and dust," she wrote on March 21, 1792, after a particularly bad night of nerves. It was already another election year, the end of the president's and the vice president's terms of office. Who knew what was to come? Southern members of the House seemed determined not just to oppose the Secretary of the Treasury, but to destroy him, while much of the press joined in the assault. Not even the president escaped their venom any longer. Oddly, it was only the vice president now who was allowed to sleep in peace, though this hardly compensated for Abigail's worry for the country. "I firmly believe," she darkly forecast to Mary, "if I live 10 years longer, I shall see a division of the southern and northern states, unless more candor and less intrigue, of which I have no hopes, should prevail." Adams was more sanguine. If frequently exhausted by his labors and distressed over her ailments, he appears to have come to terms with his marginal role in the order of things. It had been a painful process, but he had at last learned the part he was supposed to play, and to a large degree accepted its limitations. Rarely did he speak in the Senate anymore. Rarely, if ever, did he intrude on Senate business. If the role of vice president made him a political cipher, as it would anyone, he could at least serve faithfully. He was in the chair every day, all day, without fail, which was a point of pride with him, but also of some worry, since he knew such sedentary confinement to be good neither for the body nor the spirit of a man habituated for a long course of years to long voyages and immense journeys. Though loyal to Washington and the administration, Adams was but nominally a Federalist, refusing steadfastly to be or to be perceived as a party man. That he had allowed no party virulence or personal reflections to escape him was also a matter of pride and consolation. If called upon to maintain order in the Senate now, he apparently had only to tap gently with his silver pencil case on the small mahogany table before him. In mid-April, her health sufficiently restored for her to travel, Abigail returned to Massachusetts. Adams followed in May, once Congress adjourned, and the long summer at home, far removed from the hornet's nest of election year politics at the Capitol, did much to restore them both. The one big change at home was that their part of town, the old, first-settled North Precinct, had been broken off from the rest of Braintree and renamed Quincy. Otherwise, town life and days on the farm went on refreshingly the same as always. Among close associates, the president had been expressing a strong desire to return to private life. He was weary of the demands of office, weary and disheartened, Washington said, by party rancor and a severely partisan press that had taken to calling him the American Caesar. Many of the harshest attacks on Hamilton's economic policies, and some of the more biting comments on Washington himself, came from the National Gazette, a newspaper newly established in Philadelphia as an antidote to the partisan Federalist views of the Gazette of the United States, to which Alexander Hamilton was a regular contributor of essays and money. But when it became known that the editor of the new National Gazette, Philip Freneau, had been encouraged to establish the paper by Madison and Jefferson, and that he was also employed by Jefferson as a translator in the Department of State, it appeared Jefferson himself had a hand in the attacks on the president and the administration. The most vicious assaults, however, were aimed at Hamilton, whom Freneau delighted in vilifying, and to add to the insults, such diatribes were nearly always accompanied by lavish praise for Jefferson. Washington claimed to disregard newspaper abuse, but privately asked Jefferson to intercede with Freneau and remove him from the State Department. Jefferson insisted that Freneau and his paper were saving the country from monarchy, and persuaded Washington that it would be a grave misstep to impede on freedom of the press. Even more aggravating for the president was the unrelenting feud between Jefferson and Hamilton, the two highest officers in his cabinet and the most gifted. Animosity between them had reached the point where they could hardly bear to be in the same room. Each was certain the other was a dangerous man intent on dominating the government, and each privately complained of the other to the president. The one, Hamilton, disliked and distrusted the French, while for the good of the American economy strongly favoring better relations with Britain. The other, Jefferson, disliked and distrusted the British, while seeing in France and the French Revolution the embodiment of the highest ideals of the American Revolution. To Jefferson, Hamilton was not only a monarchist, but for a monarchy bottomed on corruption. To Hamilton, Jefferson belonged among those pretenders to profound knowledge who were ignorant of the most useful of all sciences, the science of human nature. The day would come, Hamilton warned, when Jefferson would be revealed as a voluptuary and an intriguing incendiary. Washington urged mutual forbearances and temporizing yieldings on all sides. To Hamilton, he expressed a deep melancholy that a fabric so goodly, erected under so many providential circumstances, should be racked by controversy and brought to the edge of collapse. On one issue only were Hamilton and Jefferson in agreement, that for the sake of the country, Washington must serve a second term, as he alone could hold the Union together. "North and South will hang together if they have you to hang on," Jefferson told Washington. There were very few such uniquely eminent individuals upon whom society had peculiar claims, Jefferson insisted. Among that indispensable few, however, Jefferson did not count himself. His own intention was to retire. In the National Gazette, Freneau warned that plain American Republicans stood to be overwhelmed by those monarchical writers on Davila, etc., who were spreading their poison doctrines throughout this blessed continent. To commemorate July 4th, the paper declared, "Another revolution must and will be brought about in favor of the people." Seeing themselves as representing the true spirit of Republican ideals, Jefferson, Madison, Freneau, and others allied with them, had begun calling themselves Republicans, thus implying that the Federalists were not, but rather monarchists, or monocrats, as Jefferson preferred to say. And while there was as yet some question whether it was Jefferson or Madison who led the Republicans, there was no doubt about who led the Federalists. It was Hamilton, who was more than a match for anyone. Hamilton, for his part, had no intention of diverting votes from Adams this time around. Aaron Burr, a New York Republican and Hamilton's nemesis, was in the running for vice president, and so Hamilton was happy now to laud Adams as a real friend to genuine liberty, order, and stable government. Early in September, Hamilton sent an urgent letter to Quincy telling Adams he must return to Philadelphia with all possible speed. Adams's absence from the scene, Hamilton warned, was benefiting the candidacy of yet another more serious rival for the vice presidency, the popular governor of New York, George Clinton, a longtime anti-federalist, now in the Republican camp. "I am persuaded you are very indifferent personally to the event of a certain election, yet I hope you are not so as to the cause of good government," Hamilton wrote. But with Congress not due to reconvene for another 2 months, and the president still declining to say whether he would serve again, Adams saw no need for hurry and remained where he was. What annoyed him exceedingly, he confided to Abigail, was the idea that George Clinton could ever be regarded as a serious rival. Given the immense